Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello and welcome to The Gallery. Little Bulb Theatre is an award-winning national touring company based in the southeast of England. The company is led by the administrative director Claire Beresford, artistic director Alexander Scott, and musical director Dominic Conway, all of whom also regularly perform in their own shows, while Scott directs most of them. Little Bulb are a key example of the British tradition of multi-skilled ensembles of theatre makers who graduate together from university drama courses rather than drama schools or conservatoires. Since their inception in 2008, their work has grown and developed thanks to the support of producing structures of small to mid-scale festivals, such as Lounge on the Farm in Kent and Forest Fringe in Edinburgh, as well as the producing companies such as Battersea Arts Centre in London and Farnham Maltings in Surrey. I first came across Little Bulb at the Edinburgh Fringe 2008, where they debuted with Crocosmia, and have followed their work quite closely ever since, partly through our mutual connection to the University of Kent. Their approach to theatre-making, as discussed in this interview, is deeply interconnected with their passion and talent for music-making, commitment to ensemble ethos, and belief in constant learning and growth. Their artistic sensibility is informed by an interest in the quirkiness and complexity of the human nature, as well as the appeal of DIY, object manipulation, and visual theatre. In addition to some of the key productions surveyed here, it is worth noting that Little Bulb have also made memorable contributions to children's theatre. This interview took place on Zoom on the 26th of May, 2020. The way we normally do this is with a lot of companies whose work we are looking at, we like to start by just retracing the steps a bit and looking at where you come from as artists, you know, what your formative influences were and what led to you choosing to work in this particular way, how you developed your methodology of working and how you then ended up working in the way that you do. And it is a really interesting situation in relation to you guys because, you know, I kind of know where you come from. I was lucky to see your very first show, and I think I've seen it more than once, actually. I saw it in Edinburgh, Crocosmia, and I saw it in Canterbury. But I obviously don't know the process of how you as individuals found each other and how you found that shared sensibility and how you specifically chose, even in that very first show, to work with found music as your stimulus, because that was all about found records, wasn't it, in the second-hand show. So maybe we can piece that together, that journey of how you originally met and how you discovered that you had things in common.
We all met doing that show. And as you know, at Kent, it's your final year you get to do a specialism. I was in the contemporary performance specialism, but I really wanted to direct something and I'd never really done that before on a big scale. I just wanted to work with the people that I'd come to know through all the various theatre things happening at uni. So Blair was in my year, Don was in the year below, but I knew him through some of the things he was doing, like do-it-yourself drama sort of projects going on. And Shamira was in the year below that. So it was strung out across all the different years. And it was a dream, really, because I just sort of had little chats with everyone and said, really want to do a show. And we didn't know what it would be.
So this was the contemporary performance practice specialism at the University of Kent, where the focus is on, let's say, devising and practices drawn from contemporary performance, performance art, live art, and so on. So this was the year 2008, I think, if I remember correctly. Yeah. But you'd already sort of developed it in the spring, presumably, of that year. And then you took it to Edinburgh and then it became quite a success in Edinburgh as well. So I'm interested in you as individuals. Presumably, You all had some sort of musical training before. Tell me, how did you discover your interest in theatre and in music before you actually found each other?
I was really basically torn between music and theatre. Like I actually applied for some courses to do either. And funnily enough, on music courses, I was told, oh, you're not really good enough, but your speech was really good. And then in acting, in drama school auditions, it was like, oh, but your song was great. So I found I was always really torn and I didn't know really what to do. And after applying for drama school and being terrible at it and not getting into music, I essentially thought, I do love academia, but I really want to do it practically. I can't seem to get myself into the just performance courses. But I do love academia, so I'll go to uni. And there was this year abroad. And then during that time, I met other people who, I don't think there's a music course at Kent, but for example, I remember talking to Don one night on a walk back. I can't remember where we were, but just talking about the fact that we both used to be in funk bands when we were teenagers. And working with Alex on projects, because me and Alex were in the same year, so we'd worked together on one of the earlier performance modules. And then I think just got really kind of excited by, you know, when you just meet somebody and you're like, oh yeah, and you're just pinging off things and you have the same aims and you enjoy working together. And but then for Cacosme, I remember Alex sort of had words that he was really interested in, and correct me if I'm wrong, Al, but it was kind of families and record players and memories of through record players. And I hadn't listened to a record player for yonks before that, but I just loved it. I was all quite new to devising when I came to Kent. I've been more involved in bands and choirs, but I hadn't really put that through a devising lens, or I hadn't really done any devising really. So that's where I kind of came from. But always loved music. I wouldn't call myself a musician, but I was always doing music, so I was, but in that not a way that's classically trained or anything.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Dom?
I think that all throughout growing up, I was really into acting, doing little shows for your parents and getting friends to do random scenes and whatnot. And I think round about when puberty hit, my interest in theatre started to really diminish, and music was a much safer space, because I think suddenly, you know, with all the acne and feeling really awkward and the things that had attracted me to theatre, I felt a bit uncomfortable and a bit shy. But in music, you could explore these rougher textures, and it was just a bit of an escape, really. Played loads of music all throughout my teenage years. It was probably my real passion. But I always sensed that I couldn't study music because it was so much a kind of therapy for me as much as anything else. And I never got on well where you had to play a piece from start to finish without making any mistakes. And I sensed that there'd be a lot of that studying music. I think I was always just preferred using it in a very organic way. And so going to Kent, I don't think I applied to anywhere else. I think I was quite unsure as to what I wanted to do. Kent was certainly, I put all my eggs in that basket because I really liked the location, because I love that whole East Kent coast. Coming to uni, as Claire said, because there wasn't a music course, there was loads of opportunities for a musician. There were different open mic nights or places to play gigs. It wasn't an astonishing music scene, but I ended up doing a lot of shows that involved me being a musician, and found playing music in a theatre context so rewarding, because you have very unusual challenges to come up with a piece of music to serve a very specific function, or to teach non-musicians how to play an instrument in a theatre context, and just to explore the presence of music and the presence of the musician felt a huge relief from the kind of pressure that had built up in my teenage years. There were some amazing musicians at my school, so the competition was really high, and it was wonderful coming to uni and exploring music in a completely different environment.
I'm nothing special. In fact, I'm a bit of a bore.
Not to us.
If I tell a joke, you've probably heard it before.
Seems unlikely.
But I have a talent, a wonderful thing. 'Cause everyone listens when I start to sing. I'm so grateful and proud. All I want is to sing it out loud. So I say...
I've no idea if whales sing bridges, but I'm going to give it a go.
I've been so lucky.
They do.
I am a humpback and a male. I want to sing it out to everybody. What a joy, what a life, what a whale.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Muswell Hill.
Oh, okay, a Londoner, basically.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah.
What about you, Claire?
Oh, I grew up in a place called Congleton in Cheshire.
Okay.
So, like, northwest.
Northwest. And you, Alex?
In Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
And a mixture of, we used to live in a sort of suburb of Cambridge, and then we moved to a village far out of Cambridge. So I sort of had those two upbringings, although I'm originally from London. So I grew up in, mm-hmm. my early years was like East End of London, but it's very distant memory.
And what about your kind of interests growing up, and what led you to choose Kent as a place to go?
I always loved music. I knew it was always something I loved to listen to, either classical music or like music from the 60s. But I think I basically imbibed, yeah. One thing that was an inspiration for Crocosmia was just me listening to my dad's record collection a lot. And so I guess I inherited a lot of those things. Yeah, and I just loved listening to it. And I loved music in film. I was always a big fan of soundtracks and how music in cinema creates a sort of emotion in a way that it didn't often in plays that I was seeing. And I was obviously addicted to theatre, and I got really, I think the bit where I got really into devised theatre was that I saw Spirit by Improbable at a tiny theatre in Cambridge. I think it's since closed down now. I mean, it was so small, and I just didn't know theatre could be like that. From then on, I was sort of hooked. So I was getting into a lot of theatre stuff, but theatre was always separate from music. I really fell in love with playing music when I just got into playing the piano. And I just sort of taught myself a way of playing, but like a really idiosyncratic, you know, not trained at all. But like Don was saying about therapy, like I was working as a cleaner at the time, and there was like a room in the school that I was cleaning with a grand piano, and I would go in there and I could bank like 4 hours at a time. Obviously not on shift. This was like, you know, like when the
cleaning
when
the keys finished, again and again.
Yeah, again. You know, and it was so therapeutic, but I never played with people until I went to university. So I think I did a bit like Claire, like I was applying for, I was like, I'm really into theatre, so I'll apply for some drama courses. And I was doing those sort of monologues and it just didn't feel right. And mm-hmm. I think they could tell. And like one of the guys did a really funny comment. He was like, your monologues, no, but you did quite well in that physical bit, you know, and it was just clear, like, it just wasn't for me. But yeah, like, really into that academic side as well. So yeah, eventually I just chose Kent. It just sort of felt right for some reason. I feel like one of the times I started really playing music was us all in like those early days, because Dom and I were living together at uni. We were in a shared house, and Dom's just so good at like going, oh, here you go, there's a guitar, you play this chord and I'll do this, and you know, and it was amazing. Like I remember we did like all sorts of like random recordings and things like that. It was very just sweet way of passing the time, but with very low pressure and actually being a nice thing. And because I think music for a lot of people gets delivered in like a pressurized way, so that was the formation of like just experimenting with having things. And I think another thing that I said in those first chats when we were talking about doing Crocosmia was that I'd just seen, I think it was Arcade Fire, I'd seen an amazing gig that they'd done. I didn't really know the band. I didn't know how big they were, but the energy in the audience just blew me away, and they were responding to the energy in the audience. So I just sort of felt like, I don't know how we're going to do it, but I want to do a show where it matters so much to the audience what we're doing, and we've got that much energy. The audience feels compelled to give us the energy. And I just remember thinking, oh gosh, if we can just sort of tap into that way of being, that would just be so exciting. So much music that really resonates is theatrical. On stage, they just had this amazing energy, like they were running around, doing things. They'd had loads of really theatrical moments. It was just really inspiring. I remember when we were doing Crocosmia, one of the ways that we developed it was we did a gig in the student bar, and it was like we were playing these kid characters. And we did a weird gig, I mean, it was totally weird, like with the kids band doing it. But it was so funny and exciting because of it being these characters doing it.
Yeah.
So it had this sort of funny energy, and we often do that, or like do almost like gigs first. That's normally like one of the first things that we do.
I see. When we're making something. That's interesting.
Like, yeah, just do a random gig. Like, I can remember quite a few of our shows at an early point, we do a gig and you see how the music's connecting to the audience.
And that's very clear in your work, that there is this sense of ensemble authorship. But it's also interesting, Alex, that you said at the beginning that you kind of wanted to direct, and then you also didn't choose the directing specialism. So was that a conscious choice in some way? Why did you choose CPP as opposed to directing in your case, when you said you really wanted to direct?
I think I just could never imagine myself doing the director's pathway, even though that was a director's thing and I really did want to direct. But I suppose what was so freeing about the CPP thing is it was, you can do anything. We do have a sort of hybrid model. It's different on different shows, but sometimes, like if we do have a director, it's very much still a thing of, well, that also means being the, like a bit of the writer as well. But we are sort of fluid with those roles, and it's, you don't know at the beginning where the project's going, but you just know that you've started a project. And I really like that. Although I think it's an amazing skill to do it like the other way, where you're directing an existing amazing play, it just wasn't as exciting. What really excited me was that we started the project just knowing, oh, it would be great to work with each other and like have that fun energy together. It would be so interesting to see what we come up with. And then we get to do all these like different roles within it. Because I love devising, just because it gives you that sense of, if you didn't like something, you could change it. Because it's very hard to find classic texts that don't have some sort of thing that you don't like. But in devising, you just change it.
so
it's not a problem.
Crocosmia was about family, but mostly about a story told from the point of view of the kids, and two of them are twins and one is a younger sister, and they're kind of remembering their parents, who we find out eventually have died. With Crocosmia, then, from what I understand, the departure point was this record collection that you found in a secondhand shop.
I think it was just the idea of records, this family record collection. And I was just going around charity shops, buying interesting looking records. And then bringing those in, we bought a secondhand record player, and then we would play the records and react to the records. And the records really were the jumping off point. But then everything else came from that. Like, did we always say it was a family record collection? So maybe that led us down to these sort of children characters emerged. And then we thought, oh, their parents don't seem to be around much. So then we were sort of investigating that. And then we developed a story, which is sort of sees them, they're orphans telling their story. And pretty much everything came out of these records that were just found by chance. So it was, we were finding different things, we were playing different things, and we were doing a lot of exercises to music. Mm. And I think a lot of the early exercises that we were doing were just things like playing the music and then reacting to the music and taking it in turns to react to the music in different ways. So we really built in that idea of the music, even though it's recorded music, but it's sort of coming from the stage, and the performers were manipulating it and putting on the records, which is actually quite hard to do. Just really felt organic. It was quite a long time period as well. It was the longest I'd worked on a show, for sure. Because it was, I think we worked out, it was about 12 weeks. Now that wasn't full time, but it was a lot of gestation. You know, I think we were rehearsing 2 or 3 times a week at least, and constantly towards the end.
I think we also taught each other songs that maybe we'd known from like childhood, and so there was a sense of us getting to know each other, not just as performers, but as musicians, but not with like a score or anything. It was just like an oral, like, oh, I sing that line, you sing it back, bouncing off each other in that way. And
those songs went into the show. Some of those songs did go into the show,
yeah. And because we're children, you could just be so free with it, because, you know, when you're a kid and you're singing songs or you're learning songs, you're not thinking, oh, that's not the way you're supposed to do it. You're just following your instincts. And actually, it was really exciting because it felt, I don't know actually, Alex, how much you directed before that, but it really felt like Alex had all this stuff he wanted to try. And there was just so, it just felt really exciting to kind of be like, wow, okay, let's be these harsh fish people today. Let's do this thing. Let's draw to music. It was a really exciting process. And I remember it so fondly.
The piece that you made in your own class, sorry to make a slight digression, what was the actual form of it?
It was an exploration of angels, I think. I don't know, I was just really fascinated by it in all its aspects, but not just a religious sense. And so I started to develop a map, like a tour, where people would go around, and some places there was like headphone bits, and a lot of people were just standing in famous poses or in the statue of, or referencing, or like angels hidden in bedrooms or all around the city. And yeah, at the very end, I really wanted people to kind of have what is associated with sort of an angelic sound experience. And so the very last bit, after they'd been on this big tour of walking themselves around various stations in Canterbury, was in Greyfriars Gardens. There's a tiny outhouse where the monks live, really tiny, and in the bottom floor there was a chamber choir that sang for us. And then you went upstairs, and this lovely guy, who I still speak to now actually, called Alex, different Alex, played a Benjamin Britten song on the harp, and he'd written it all out so people knew what he was playing. And then all the angels that had been statues kind of around Canterbury all came in to the other side of the garden, because it's like two gardens. And so when you walked out of the music experience, and Dom and Alex were also part of the angel exhibition, so they were all sat on the other side when you came out. It's called The Art of Watching, because I was fascinated by the idea of people looking out for people and how you could be angelic in that sense, even if you obviously aren't a real angel. Mm-hmm. I think I was thinking about it initially quite visually, but definitely sound became a bit, and how that makes you feel became a big part of it.
Dom, you then did CPP in the year after.
Yeah, so by the time it got to me, the intake of students had swelled so much that they stopped doing individual options for the CPP students. And I think we were a group of 9, because it was like we were a group of friends, and there was no easy way to divide us, and we wanted to try working as a big group, and it was called Big Love or The Dark and Violent World of Mr. Fight-A-Lot. Because there were so many people, I think it took the structure that everyone had a bit or a character that was all threaded together. And I think one of the main things I ended up doing was basically borrowing Camille O'Sullivan's interpretation of a Tom Waits song called Misery's the River of the World. It was a shameless bit of theft, really, although I suppose she and herself had stolen it. But I definitely took her version and like did it. I made my own backing track and did it, I think, in a dress, like kind of not exactly in drag. That was like my contribution.
I remember being very impassioned, your performance. I remember you standing on a chair. I saw it land on the farm, so I don't.
Yeah. So, well, it's an all or nothing song.
Yeah.
So then eventually you all graduated, Shamira included eventually after you, Dom. Then I saw a few of your gigs, like you did a gig for Forest Fringe 1 year in Edinburgh. What I'm getting at is before Operation Greenfield came, in my memory, is the next really show, theatre show, right? Sporadical was kind of theatrical, but I saw it more as a gig than as a theatre piece.
That's interesting that you would see that as a gig more than theatre in terms of, because it had a narrative, but obviously definitely it was mainly songs strung together by a narrative. But yeah, we called it a sort of cardboard folk opera, but an epic cardboard folk opera. But when you mentioned gig theatre, really, I was thinking, oh, I guess if I had to put our own shows in that camp, which one's clearly gig theatre? And I think I'd put a show called Whale in that camp, which was about whale song. But definitely there are loads of other shows that I guess you could say, well, that was like the recent one we did at BAC, they're called The Future. That was like a TED Talk meets a sort of prog rocky kind of gig. But yeah, where's the line between like, is that a theatre show with songs in it? For other things I see, I think, oh yeah, that's clearly gig theatre. But I'm not very good at maybe working out when I would apply it to us, even though I'm sure we've probably, maybe have we described our work as that before?
I didn't think we ever
had. We haven't. No,
I think of that as a bit of a newer phrase. But
yeah.
I mean, I sort of don't feel like that we're swimming around when we were starting out. We've done a lot of more like gigs, but theatrical gigs at the Shunt Lounge. They're what I think of as more like, you know, gig theatre. But then a lot of our shows do just have gigs in them randomly. Like Operation Greenfield ends with a gig.
I am the true vine. I am the true vine. I am the true vine. I am the true vine.
That was quite spectacular, I think, actually. Was that 2010, Operation Greenfield?
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's probably, maybe not that year, but soon after, I heard the term gig theatre being retrospectively applied to that show. Somehow, I mean, obviously, gig theatre as a term came from journalists primarily, didn't it? And it wasn't necessarily introduced by artists, but it kind of became attached to a number of works using live music the way you do.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because I think there's more of a conscious thing now about it. I definitely think you can retrospectively say, like, some of our stuff has been really gig, like, if I understand it right. But yeah, we weren't applying that at the time.
Yeah.
And it felt quite fun and like felt like we were doing something a bit, or certainly new to us as well. It was a new thing that we were doing, and really fun to just have music be so prominent. Like, I was really excited about how we were using songs, recorded songs as well, and being able to reference them and like start singing along to them. And whereas for Cosmere, there'd definitely been lots of music. Operation Greenfield felt like it was completely about music and about teenagers getting obsessed with music. And
yes,
music was just happening nonstop. And then like either being created or listened to and then sung along to and all that.
I mean, there's a whole other project that we did, which was very much a gig, which was called Goose Party.
Yeah, we haven't remember that.
The idea was to go to Edinburgh, not as undercover. Little Bowl, but we developed a show. It was like three sets. There was like a folky set and then a kind of angsty rock set and then a kind of crazy party set. And we did costume changes between each one. I think we were very much thinking of that as being like a band project, but it was definitely read as a show.
That was gig theatre.
Yeah.
You can't say that wasn't gig theatre.
There was a lot of theatrics, but I think maybe it read as a bit more performance art than we had imagined when we were working on it.
Yeah, in the way that some rock bands bleed over into performance art.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was more like in that space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We definitely do perform as a band, but it pretty much is always, unless it is a wedding or a friend's party, it's normally always in a theatrical context. So if we're performing at a festival, we'll be in the theatre tent, most likely, or like we performed on the Riverside stage at the National, but again, as a band of ourselves that we call the Hot Club that came out of the Orpheus project. If you saw as you're walking past, you wouldn't think that's a theatre company necessarily. But it's definitely on a stage that's associated with theatre.
Then the story of Operation Greenfield is kind of a rite of passage in a way, isn't it? It's set in a village. In fact, earlier when Dom was talking about his teenage years, the reason I asked where are you from was because I was remembering that show. And obviously it's a very different setting that you grew up in, presumably in Muswell Hill. What was the story of Operation Greenfield, just very briefly?
There's a few stories playing out. Each character's kind of got their journey through it. But there's some teenagers starting a band and entering their local village talent competition. And at the same time, there's someone new to the village who's come from France, who's joined their friendship group. And yeah, it's definitely about the band forming with this new person being a bit of a cat among the pigeons.
And it's about, I guess, those classic things of being young or teenage, that they're expressing themselves through music and they're coming together and they're dealing with the ups and downs of friendship and tentatively displaying their sexuality in the world and about how they negotiate that. The village life is sort of, it's safe, it's somewhere in Middle England, but we don't quite know where. And yeah, it's sort of about them all trying to express themselves, I think. It's that sort of painful teenage thing of it's not always coming out right and they're falling in love with each other and not being able to fully express it properly. And
yeah. You know.
But it's all coming out in the music. So like the passion's all there in the music.
And if that's the story, I think the theme, in a nutshell, I always remember, Alex, you saying that you wanted to make a show that explored Christianity without alienating either Christians or atheists. So there was definitely an ambition to try and make a meeting ground, because increasingly, I think it felt like Christianity was an easy target in culture, especially in subversive culture, and that might feel alienating. And I definitely wanted to explore that kind of fertile ground, but without really picking either side of the argument. Would you say that's kind of right, Al?
It definitely was, because I sort of felt like I grew up in a village and I sort of did hang around at churches a lot and was part of that culture. Despite not being religious myself, it's just sometimes you just do get immersed with it culturally, and just thinking Christians and Christianity, they get like, it's a bit of a sort of an easy target sometimes, especially in comedy. And that doesn't speak to like the complexity of it and the life and the culture of it. It is also the case that if you're gay and Christian, it's very challenging. You've got this other set of challenges. So Shamira's character, Alice, is in love with Eugenie's character. And it's a hard thing to process, because then I wanted to draw in both sets of, it wasn't like a political piece or like an argument piece. It was just about the characters, but I think we did hopefully get the line right. And I think maybe some people felt it was a bit strange, the line that we were taking. Because I think some people were desperate to know if we were all Christians. Yes. And then other people were not sure if we were being disrespectful, which we absolutely weren't. I felt like we weren't, and we'd got the right side of that line. But we were basically in that area, which is a sort of complex area.
Dom just summarized it in terms of this idea of an outsider coming in. And it's kind of also about belonging and community in a way, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And the way in which communities are built in those village environments is very different to how it works in cities and so on. But also it gave you a broader repertoire musically, presumably, that you were able to draw on different kinds of music in making this show.
Definitely. Sporadical and Operation Greenfield, we started at a similar time.
Yeah.
And that was definitely a time of musical training. For Claire and I, it was about re-engaging with instruments that we played a lot in childhood, as well as taking on new musical challenges. Yeah, and the same for Eugenie. I think she'd played a lot of flute and a little bit of bass before. So she was on a kind of big learning challenge for the bass guitar.
And that was sort of autobiographical. Those things came about autobiographically. We were just sort of into the story. I mean, that was basically the plot, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And with, sorry, Dom, I interrupted.
No, not at all. But with Shamira, she played a bit of harmonica, a tiny bit of keyboard. I don't know, maybe a chord of guitar, but really hadn't fully embraced an instrument as in like, oh, this is my main instrument. But well, perhaps you'd say harmonica, but I remember going to a music shop with her. We were all there, and it was a bit like in Harry Potter where they're choosing their wands, or, you know, we were in that amazing music shop, I think it's called Rayman.
Yeah, in Camden.
And it was really like, wow, our friend's going to choose her instrument. And we were all like picking different ones up, saying, maybe you'd be good at this. And then what she ended up gravitating towards was, I don't think anything was purchased that day at the shop, but there was an accordion, Alex, that you'd found on eBay.
I think I found it, yeah. And just thought it would be good for the sporadical, maybe the folk opera.
Yeah, and she just fell in love with it. Right from early days of the company, we kind of established a thing of, on nearly every show, someone is learning an instrument, or sometimes we're all learning instruments. And I think definitely coming out of university, there was a sense that our actual contact hours had been quite slim in terms of training. And we were very keen to develop what skills we did have. And so a large part of a lot of our rehearsals are just doing rudimentary instrument practice or more advanced studies. But yeah, after that show, we had a bunch of songs that we could play as a band that were all really related to that show. And then people would often say, oh, you do a lot of music in your shows. Could you do a gig in our theatre foyer? And we'd always end up putting together these really odd set lists. Quite a lot of our early years, every set would have included some really random songs that we'd learned specifically for that occasion, because we wanted to do the gig, but we didn't necessarily have the repertoire. The skills that we did have were quite kind of newly learned and specific to a show.
That's really interesting. So actually, I mean, that journey then in relation to Crocosmia, where I don't remember you playing any instruments in the show. I just remember the records.
Yeah. Yeah, and then no instruments in it.
There were no instruments. And then you obviously as a company made the conscious decision that you wanted to commit to live musical performance in your shows.
Instruments were in the room in Crocosmia. I often had a guitar in, Shamira had her harmonica, but I think we just started to feel like as soon as we played the instruments, we didn't look credible as kids anymore. It kind of shattered that. So they were on the verge of inclusion.
It was a cappella singing. Mm. There was quite a few a cappella songs. We had to reduce it to the ones that felt right. But then Operation Greenfield is all about being a teenage band, so it just made sense to have the instruments. And I think because we denied ourselves that in Crocosmia, we were really up for it. And there's like evolution of instruments as well, isn't there? There's that fun moment where you know, Eugenie gets her basses. They get presents for Christmas. There's like a scene where they get their new instruments, like they all plug in and stuff. I suppose another fun thing about Operation Greenfield was the first time that I can remember us working on an ambitious cover of, because we had the Gorecki, the symphony cover at the end. And we also, it was our first, or what I think it was like more complicated harmony work, looking at the Teze song.
Yeah, that's true.
And that was a real delight. You know, and I just love having the technical challenge of you doing those like harder pieces. And it always gives you something to do. There's always the musical well to get water from.
Yes.
And then that can make you think about the character. I think it just gives you longer to think about the characters and about what the sequencing should be and what the narrative should be. I think that feels like it emerges after like lots of just drilling and
music. And actually, you said earlier, Alex, that there was a sense of autobiographical decision making going on there in terms of the instruments. But was Operation Greenfield in any way consciously working with any of your autobiographies in terms of generating material?
I think there is a bit of that in there, but it's quite subtle. Like, we have a bit of a company mantra that like whatever's going on in our lives is basically what the show is about. I think Crocosmia was about a family coming together moment, you know, and that was sort of like us coming together. And the plot of Operation Greenfield is someone new comes along, and that's when you, like, Eugenie joined. We'd known Eugenie from, she was on an exchange year at Kent. That was all went into the narrative. On the shows that I direct, I sometimes think there is definitely like an autobiographical lens of viewing it. I think it's quite hard to tell that that's what is going on some of the times. Like, I just like that it feels very personal, like when I see the shows, and a lot of it feels really personal or autobiographical in some ways, just because I think some of the pathways that the narrative goes down. But we're not in that genre of this is my life and I'm going to tell you about it.
No. But Dushka,
yes,
to answer that question another way, and to go back to what you were saying about when you were asking if I grew up in a village, I think I see it similar to Al. There's autobiography hanging around the show, but you're not always drawing just from your own autobiography, and your autobiography's kind of become a shared pool to draw from. So I had very little experience with Christianity, and I didn't grow up in a village, but I did have an experience of being in a lot of teenage bands, and the kind of awkwardness of those rehearsals. It felt like I was mining that seam of autobiography alongside a world that felt very unfamiliar to me. And I think sometimes the things that I was unfamiliar with, I'd say, really, was it like this at Christian clubs? And sometimes, like, Claire and Alex might be like, oh, yeah, no, that's very, that's very credible. And so, yeah, you could kind of help each other. as long as somebody's had a lived experience, they can lend that authenticity to the others who don't have it.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of nice weaving it in as like subliminal code, because I think we wanted to create a new fiction.
Mm.
It wanted to feel like it was a new thing, but we fed it with a lot of real things. It does blur a line.
Yes.
But I don't know, that does felt like the correct way of creating it.
And okay, this is not such a central issue. I mean, I was just curious about it because you mentioned autobiographical references there. So
what is autobiographical, Dushka, in some ways, is the instruments that Dom, Eugenie and I played as teenagers.
Right.
Were what we played. Yes. So Alice basically said, what did you play as teenagers?
Right.
And yeah. I said, oh, I started to learn the drums and I've always loved singing. And Dom was like, well, I've been playing guitar forever. And we were like, oh, I hope Eugenie plays bass. And when she said, we were like, yeah, basically got bass. and bonusly, had done a bit of flute. So actually, it really helped to get into your teenage self by playing the instrument that your teenage self had had a bash at. So that was, in that sense, it was.
We did do some hilarious exercises where it was like, be yourself as a teenager. talking about various, you know, various things. It all sort of fed into it. And actually it was quite sort of fun doing it. The other thing was we had this sort of weird texture of like mathematics and precision.
Mm.
And at first, like, that felt like, oh gosh, it's so stylized. But then weirdly, like, it felt like it found its way organically to being like an analogy for just how awkward teenagers can be. And they were sort of moving around the stage very regimentedly.
Mm-hmm.
But that was another weird thing. Like, I don't fully know where that came from, although we were using that Philip Glass Einstein on the beach. You know, that classic counting, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, that sort of thing. That's sort of like heavily in the soundtrack, isn't it?
Maybe what I should quickly say, Dushka, and I'm not sure this will be helpful or not, is that, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, Al, but like sometimes, Alex, what I find amazing is how personal things become, in a way, things that maybe are autobiographical come out of the process, but that the process is sometimes Alex giving us a box of things or an exercise or an invitation, and out of that we fill it with ourselves, with the character that we've created, and then all together that fuses to become something that feels really personal, really truthful, but is invented at the same time. And Alex, there's no way he could have known what we would have put into that task, and yet it always feels like, in retrospect, I'm like, Alex, how did you know? But it's just random. But like,
great. I want to also then go forward a little bit to Orpheus. I know I'm probably skipping some important works here, but I was thinking of Orpheus again earlier when Dom mentioned at the beginning of this conversation about how little sort of precision mattered to you. I don't know, but that wasn't the word you used. You used something else when you were talking about...
Oh, yeah, just that I always found that a very daunting approach to music.
And yet then you find yourself in a situation where you have to play Django Reinhardt and actually be convincing as him. How did that come
well,
about?
I always say that I think at some point I remember saying to Alex, oh, you know, it would be fun, like in 10 years time we should, you know, just like practice loads and do a biopic of Django. Maybe we both were sort of saying that because we were both big Django fans. And then...
No, I think that's you who said that, Dom. Because you'd... I mean, I'd sort of listened to Django when I was younger. That was sort of another thing that I used to love. But you would... You actually knew the songs and you'd, like, written lyrics to them. And, like, you were heavily invested. And you'd done that sort of... Hadn't you done that sort of training in Cuba?
Yeah, I did study music in Cuba in my gap year, and I did have a kind of Django Reinhardt band out there for a few months with a wonderful Haitian violinist. I was obsessed with Django, but playing with very bad technique. and then when this BAC commission came through and they really said we could do anything, and it was on Alex to come up with the idea, And then, well, Al, perhaps at some point you could say more about the rest of the idea and how that came to you. But basically, Al said, yeah, I think we should do the story of Orpheus, and I think we should use, you know, the music of Django, and Dom, I think you should play Django. And I had one of my characteristic actor fits. I was like, no, what are you talking about? We'll never be ready. It would take far too long. I was terrified. I think I went home and immediately began begrudgingly practicing. Like, well, if we're going to do this, then I'm not going to waste a moment. But I think it's a terrible idea. But I'll start practicing anyway. And it for ages.
For us, we had so much further more to go, because Dom already like knew quite a lot of the songs and like could play, I think, to most ears fairly well. Like when we started, Dom was musically directing the show. And we started, we had these very sweet, like, jazz circles, and we would go around and Dom was helping us to, like, jazz improv. I've never done that. And I think quite a lot of other people have never played jazz. So poor us, Dom, you already knew quite a lot.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, Claire learned double bass for the show, and Alex learned clarinet for the show. Everyone had huge musical challenges, and I would say in terms of the guitar, yeah, I end up playing guitar in most Little Bulb shows, but that felt a bit like learning a new instrument, because it was a completely different technique. There was a lot of learning to undo habits. There was a lot of moments that felt really like the basics of an instrument, like how do you hold a plectrum, how do you strike the strings. And it's an ongoing journey, because people in that genre dedicate their life to it. And there's a lot of incredibly good, essentially amateur players. They don't gig, you know, they might gig, but it's not how they earn their living, basically. But they just are so into the music, and it's so codified that their level of playing is astonishing. And any jazz player or gypsy jazz player will always say that they're on the first rung of the ladder. Even from the first show, like when we opened the show, I was approaching the songs in a very different way from 5 years later, because I did as much as I could in terms of approaching this technique, and then we opened. And I fell back to like my teenage guitar technique, because you sometimes have that in shows. When you perform it, a different instinct kicks in. And it took me ages to execute the right technique in performance. And oh, it's very tricky.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Ladies and gentlemen, do not worry. For the next half an hour, your care will be taken away from you. The melodious sounds of music. Feel free to come and go. Feel free to converse. And most importantly, the wine shall flow. Since dance the lucky ups are fun. And it today the power key. Comme un dieu, il jouait. On parle d'Orphée chaque fois. Avec sa lyre, il rentre ses doigts. Il nous donne le raison de vivre. Il écoute tout le monde et fait de nouvelles chansons. Mais rien ne peut ramener ni son cœur ni la fille. Chaque poisson de résistance. il voulait conquérir sa femme avec le pouvoir d'unir son âme. On veut pauvre anglais. Mais la mort qu'un homme l'a changé, l'a changé.
What I think is amazing about music is it's a bit, it must be a bit like how Shakespearean actors feel about Shakespeare, is that there's no point at which you're like, yeah, I get it, I know what he means. Every age you are, it means something new, it means something different. You can perform something 100 times and then suddenly on the 101st you find this new colour in the language or this new meaning. And I personally really wrestle, and I've been thinking about it a lot this lockdown actually, about after me and Dom were in the like debates about this, but I really struggle with like discipline, because I feel music feels like it comes from my hips and my heart and my mouth, and it's very organic, and it's like, and I tried as a teenager to sort of do, I can read music and I did have lessons, but I didn't find it was like that was a natural outlet. My family aren't musical, but my mum and my dad are all, they love dancing, and they couldn't read a musical note. So I feel it in a certain way, and I often think I fight against the, but I also know that to get anywhere better, that you do, it takes hours and hours and hours of practice, and so I end up in this sort of halfway house thing. Another interesting thing about doing the Orpheus was we did a lot of training at a place called the Cucumber in Latchmere in London, which is just down the road from Battersea Arts Centre. And it's placed in like seemingly...
Which like by fortune was, it's like the right, only...
The only gypsy jazz bar right down the road from
and
BAC.
It just happened to be like next door.
Amazing.
But speaking about like sort of technique versus performance, what I found fascinating about there is every Tuesday they had this like open mic night, and we basically spent ages training to try and be a legitimate gypsy jazz band as the thing that we were working on first and foremost, and then alongside the story. But there would be, like Dom said, these musicians that were like unbelievable, but they're playing for free, and they, you would never have heard of them, and you probably will never hear them unless you go there, because it's this very insular, isolated, like, but incredibly talented. But what I love about theatre is that sometimes a not so technically perfect musician can be elevated to this like amazing feeling. I think we're interested in this kind of like battle between, why is it that some musicians or performers are technically amazing, but they make you feel nothing, and some people who maybe are maybe not the best, but you just have this thing where theatre can like take music up a level, and it's really opened me up to being more playful. Like when artists like, oh, can you give this a go, pass me about, be like, I'm not a musician, I can't play, I'm not allowed. But it's very much like, take anything, it's like, get a pencil, anyone can draw. There obviously are writer ways if you want to learn that way, but there's also a billion other ways. And yeah, I need to be more disciplined. I'm fascinated by using where your passions and where your organicness takes you with music in that respect.
That was amazing, Claire. Sorry. That was kind of a bravura performance in itself.
Sorry.
Thank you. You said so many interesting things in what you've just said, you know, and kind of anticipated some of my questions. I was going to ask you about what music means to you in terms of theatre making, and that theatre takes music up a level. It was quite an interesting insight. Maybe to just bring this to a conclusion somehow, and to maybe reflect a little bit on how you as a company and as a band have now existed for over 10 years. It's nearly, 12 years. And I'm interested in what you feel has contributed to that longevity. And also, you now have kind of very specific roles in the running of the company. I've seen that division of labor has happened in some very grown-up ways now as part of having to just maintain the company. And then, of course, certain life decisions have had to be made about where you live, how you live, and so on. And I'm interested in how that's a factor in keeping the company going, and what your work has become now, and how do you work as a band and as a company under current circumstances?
We're definitely in a different moment from when we started. I have a child. That's crazy. Yeah, it feels like we're in... like a different chapter, but I just got a sense that, you know, you just know nothing when you're beginning. You're just doing everything off instinct. All the decisions, like when I think back to those early shows and just think, it was all instinct. It wasn't planned. None of it was planned. And I think it feels like you're just constantly on a bit of a tidal wave. And I don't think our university training was about the practicalities of how you run a company. So I think, I mean, obviously it has to be about other stuff. But I feel like we've learned a lot in the last 10 years or 12 years and made loads of mistakes and therefore learned from all the mistakes. And there's just been loads of fun moments along the way as well. So I feel like we've had a lot of fun. We've made a lot of mistakes. We've made a lot of shows. You know, we've done a lot. But I think if we're in the beginning of a new chapter, it feels like we're a bit more in control of that process, you know, just slightly more.
Do you still keep learning new instruments though as part of the new phase, or are you just settling into like the skills that you have already? And
oh no, always learning. In 2015, which is now a while ago, for Extravaganza Macabre, we all decided to try and learn brass instruments. I still aspire to continue that challenge.
I'm learning the trumpet.
Oh, great.
I've recently acquired a cello, and I know Alex has always wanted to learn the cello as well, so hopefully we can.
Oh yeah, can you give me lessons, please?
Yeah, well,
give me the lessons. I adore the cello. So what I think we may do a lot of is we tend to do genre hopping quite a lot. So the last show we did, like a rural tour around village halls, is folk music, but like inspired by the Scots-Irish migration to America, and then country music. So we'd never touched that genre, the country music genre. That was just a real joy just to just try and, you only have the given time. So I think our mission is to try and get as good technically as we can in the time, and then to use theatre to hopefully get that effort across to the audience, you know. And obviously it is, you know, like Don was saying, you could be like just do the one genre all your life and still be a learner. Who said that thing about it being like a bottomless well? Or so I feel like there's, or the well is just eternally deep. Whoever you are, there'll always be something more to learn. That is very off-putting. Like, I mean, that is very daunting. But theatre is a magical way of pretending that isn't a barrier. So I think we try and go in saying, what if that sort of wasn't a barrier? Or what if we could pretend it wasn't a barrier? And it's fascinating how an audience will receive that. It can get you to, or nearer to the place than you would without the theatre. I think we come at it from a theatre angle, but we love music and we love playing it. But I just feel like the best, most captivating musicians have an innate sense of, they have something to communicate to you, and you're glad that they're doing it, and you're glad that they're talking to you in a way that feels really necessary. The technique is very useful if the technique is what helps the communication. But where it doesn't help, it isn't really important.
Yes,
but I do also find it amazing that anyone who's really pushing themselves technically, there is something really captivating in that, in the same way that, you know, when you see people do extreme sports, the spirit goes, this is important. Even that, because someone is risking something and they're doing something amazing. So I think virtuosity has that element to it, that sort of, it's someone really doing something. So we can sort of get caught up in that. But I don't think in and of itself the technique is that important. It could be the most important, but it doesn't have to be. That's, I don't know, that's how I think about it.
Great, thank you so much. It does feel like we went into detail with some of those things, and then we had to zoom out a bit and see the bigger picture. But it's extremely useful. It's just been really, really helpful to get a completely different perspective on this and to hear all your beautiful articulations of what it is that you do. So thank you so much for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Tishka.
Thanks, Tishka. It's been really lovely.
Good luck with this project. I mean, it does sound really fascinating.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.